Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's conversation features Fred Slough, partner at the law firm of Slough, Irwin & Madden. For years, Mr. Slough and his colleagues have been on the right side of history in their support of gay rights, free speech, justice for workers, and their opposition to immoral policies like apartheid. The forum asked Mr. Slough to share his sage perspective on where socialist-leaning Democrats should find focus in the wake of Bernie Sanders' meteoric rise and Hillary Clinton's crushing defeat in last year's presidential race. Slough will review strategies that the right used to win and evaluate current weaknesses in the Democratic Party, both locally and nationally. This show was recorded on May 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The Unitarian Forum is essentially a long-lasting forum in Kansas City. It's a place where you can talk about controversial topics and of the day or yesterday. Today we're really fortunate to have with us my good friend Fred Slough. Fred Slough is a partner in the law firm of Slough, Connolly, Irwin, and Madden. The whole law firm is a family friend of the Bagot family for many years. And I'm so pleased. My brother and I were talking about dark money here a while back. We went to the symposium at the Unity. I said, what are we going to do? He says, George, you ought to hear what Fred has to say about that. So I called Fred, and fortunately, he accepted to be here today. So without any further ado, I will let you talk to Fred.
Thank you very much, George. I'm honored to be invited to speak at this church where we have so many great activists that I've met and worked with over the years on many different things. I'm Fred Slough. I've been a lawyer for over 40 years now, so much that I call myself just an open-running sewer. That's been my job for so long. Now, the title of my talk is What is to be done? What is to be done? But I've decided that the title should have been What is to be done? Like I know. I don't know if any of you share this feeling, the feeling that, you know, I used to be a lot smarter than I am now. I was taught that with age comes wisdom. But I have to say, it doesn't feel that way exactly. Because I used to be so certain that I knew what should be done. But time has taught me that such clarity was unwarranted. And that kind of clarity can only belong to the young who have not seen their truth on the ropes and near dead. Now, the title, What is to be Done, comes from a famous tract by Lenin. He wrote it to his fellow communists, discussing the need for a politicized and educated vanguard to lead the workers in the right direction. And so I thought it appropriate for this speech, and I think you'll probably understand by the time I sit down. Now, my view of the United States and where we are. I hope my view is one of healthy cynicism. And I think that this poem by Langston Hughes sums it up well. It's part of his poem, Let America Be America Again. And his poem is not 100% pessimistic, and I'm not either. But I think that this expresses my true feelings about America at this time. I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I'm the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I'll tell you a little bit more about me. When I left law school in 1974, I was a member of an organization, a leftist kind of organization called the National Lawyers Guild. And I considered myself a leftist or progressive, and I was an activist. And along with others, I formed what we at that time called the Law Collective. And probably the name says enough about what we thought. Our goal was to serve the movements that we believed would change America. The anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-imperialist left that existed at that time in the anti-war movement of those days. Now, in addition to that, we were going to have low fees where anybody could afford to go to court if they needed to. And, of course, as young lawyers, we soon discovered reality. It was more difficult to do than what we thought. However, we were still committed to social change, and our lawyers have worked with the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the civil rights movement, and it's true that over the years we have seen major successes. In addition to that, I have been a First Amendment lawyer and have had the great pleasure of enforcing the free speech rights of many people whom others would prefer not to see and not hear, just prefer that they be more quiet. Just a few examples. I represented Jerry, the Westport beggar. I think people really hated me more for that. I represented this preacher, a runner, who runs around in the Superman suit. People didn't want to hear him preach on the streets either. I represented a couple called the Butterflies. They used to sit on the streets in Westport or on the sidewalks and sell trinkets and give away their aphorisms, their sayings that they made up. And I represented these people and plus a lot of activists who got arrested doing civil disobedience. I'll just mention a few of those things. During the boycott of South Africa, I don't know if you remember that. It was a while back. But Frank Sinatra refused to honor the boycott. And so he was having a concert down at Kemper Arena. And some local ministers and other people blockaded the entrances to the Kemper Arena. And those Frank Sinatra fans were some of the meanest, maddest people I've ever seen. And the police were not very kind either. So I represented the people who got arrested out of that. And Kathy Keneally and I represented some people who put on what they called the Bike-a-thon for Choice. The police forced the participants in that out of the park, out of Loose Park, claiming that the parks were for recreation only. And so we represented those women and obtained a nice settlement for each of them and a change in park policy that, of course, the parks have always been for free speech and always will be. I don't know if you would remember the great boycott in the United Farm Workers. At one point, the Teamsters engaged in a hostile takeover attempt, trying to take the union away from the United Farm Workers. And, of course, we sided with the farm workers. I remember our chant, Chavez see, Fitzsimmons no. Fitzsimmons was the head of the Teamsters at that time. So we set a protest up outside the Teamsters Hall out on what's now Cleaver Boulevard. We had a bunch of protest signs, and we were chanting and walking closer and closer to the hall where a bunch of Teamsters were standing on the porch. Now, we did not realize that we would come to a line at which we were now on Teamsters' property. And when we got to that line, here came the Teamsters. They were running at us as fast as they could, and we realized that they were not into peaceful protest. So we felt we were very happy just to escape harm that day. And I remember myself as that Teamster guy came at me, I was afraid to turn my back on the guy. And I learned that I could run backwards really fast. But I did learn one thing. Never pick at the Teamsters. Now, we did a lot of public interest work for free or reduced fees. But we learned that it was actually good for business. In doing it, we made a lot of friends. And they trusted us. And when they needed somebody, they would call us. Another advantage we had back in 1974 was our faith in the equality of women. When we went to law school, there were very few women in law school and very few women lawyers. Our early women lawyers, Marsha Walsh, Kathy Keneally, and Sally Wells, made us a whole lot of friends. And those friends wanted to go to a woman-led law firm. And so when what they needed fell into the things that I did, I got to do those cases. So maybe in spite of ourselves, we survived and eventually prospered, still doing the things we love to do, and sometimes fitting within our leftist political beliefs. Which finally gets me back to the subject of this talk, politics, social and economic justice, what is to be done? As just a shortcut to my thinking, I think you need to hear this.
Potential to be a dangerous moment.
I play that little bit for you because as bad as 2016 was, something very good and important happened. Bernie Sanders proved that the ideals of democratic socialism are something that people are no longer afraid of. You know, in all the time that I've been able to vote, I've never had a truly left politician that I could vote for. You know, every 4 years, or most 4 years, I kind of had to vote for what I felt was the lesser of two evils. In 2016, I could vote enthusiastically for Bernie Sanders. And if you look at the number of votes cast for Bernie and the number of votes cast for Trump when he pretended to be the working man's friend, you have a supermajority of voters. So how do we build on this to take back our government from the elite who run it for profit? You know, in my time, I know there are people who relate to the Greens probably here, and I related to the Greens as a third party. I considered myself a red-green. But in spite of my association with third party, I believe that our best chance ever is to make the Democratic Party into a kind of FDR, New Deal Democratic Party, by demanding the kind of policies that Bernie Sanders supported. Personally, I believe that third-party efforts, unfortunately, are going to guarantee the election of right-wing Republicans. I'm sure you remember Al Gore, the Hanging Chads, and more importantly, that in that year, Ralph Nader, as a Green, may have cost Al Gore the election. If we as Democratic Socialists run as third-party candidates, I believe that we will have the election of people like George Bush or worse, Trump. You know, we don't have a parliamentary system. It's a winner-take-all system. That's why the two capitalist parties keep trading the elections back and forth between them. So in my view, Democrats need to recruit and support candidates who make the demands of Bernie Sanders. The $15 an hour minimum wage, a solid link to Black Lives Matter, Medicare for all, separate banking from investments, no more bailouts for Wall Street, take on income inequality with taxation, and limits on CEO pay in contrast to worker pay, rebuild our infrastructure, consider a national bank to pay for it, grow trade unions and worker co-ops, protect our jobs through trade policies that no longer make it profitable to ship jobs overseas, have family-friendly policies that make excellent daycare affordable, and protect people's jobs when they're dealing with newborn babies. We need truly equal pay for women. We need to attack climate change with the best of our research, technology, and investment. And we need quality education that's affordable for all. As an aside, I'll tell you that I'm from a very working-class family. You know, on both my dad's side and mom's, there were 8 kids, and they lived on just, subsistence kind of farms. Right in the middle of the Depression, my dad was down there at a CCC camp in Texas, and he always joked that the Roosevelt administration chased my mom down and put shoes on her. But, you know, I grew up at a time when we did have affordable education. I went to Kansas State. Then I was drafted, and then I had the GI Bill. I went to an affordable law school. I got out of that with very little debt. Today, if I were a young person today, I would not be graduating from a law school. There's no way a person like me could do that. And that's wrong. I think Bernie had it just right. And finally, and I think this is very important policy, is to have a foreign policy that's not built upon empire and militarism. Now, I know there's a lot more things that we could add to that list, but you get where I'm coming from. For you today, I also have what I call my enemies list. Feel like Nixon. I got my enemies list. They are the Democratic Party insiders, an organization called the Federalist Society, what I call the American Exceptionalists, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and finally the Koch brothers and other wealthy conservatives. I'll just talk about those a little bit, each one. First of all, the party insiders. Just recently in Kansas, we had a congressional election. We had an opportunity to elect a New Deal-style social democrat. His name was James Thompson. He was running in Wichita for a seat in Congress. How much money do you think he got from the Kansas Democratic Party? Nothing. You're exactly right. Not a dime. He also requested money from the Democratic National Committee. At first, he was turned down flat. Later, they gave him $3,000. Now, if the leaders of the Democratic Party don't wake up, the huge number of Bernie kind of voters will go third party or go back to the benches, not voting. And then let's talk about the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Koch brothers and big money in politics. People like the Koch brothers and other wealthy business people can now give unlimited funds of money to help elect legislators who will do their specific bidding and generally enact a conservative agenda. Now, when these conservative folks are elected and get there in their office, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, already has off-the-rack legislation. And many states are dealing with this now, including Missouri. Here's the legislation that's ready. Privatizing education, stand-your-ground laws, laws that weaken discrimination laws, limiting the right to choice, and attacking Planned Parenthood, cracking down on immigrants, promoting harsh criminal laws and private prisons, deregulation of energy, opposition to the Affordable Care Act. Now, these are just a few of the ready-made, ready-to-go acts as soon as the conservatives get control of our legislature like they do now in Missouri. I want to talk to you briefly about the Federalist Society, our new Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, and who I call the originalist. We need courts who are not adverse to our ideas as our New Deal-style social Democrats. What we don't need is lawyers in robes who are members of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is an organization of conservatives and libertarians, and they promote what they call an originalist reading of the Constitution. Now, they were formed to oppose what they thought was a liberal bias among law school professors and the American Bar Association. Now, they're very prominent, and they're in over 200 law schools, and they have over 60,000 members around the country. They convinced George W. Bush to abandon using the ABA to rate the qualifications of federal judges. And every judge named by George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush was either a member of or approved by the Federalist Society. Now, the impact on our courts has been great. For example, Chief Justice Roberts was reportedly a member, although he claimed he couldn't remember. Antonin Scalia was a member. Samuel Alito is a member, Clarence Thomas a member, and now Gorsuch. Not only that, the Federalist Society gave Trump the list from which he chose Gorsuch. The Federalist Society believed that our judges should practice what's called the time machine approach to interpreting the Constitution. In other words, look at the words of the Constitution. What did that mean in 1789? When, for example, the right to bear arms meant a musket. And that's in practice, though. We see that this originalist agenda lines up well with a conservative Republican platform and gets results like these. Money in politics is free speech. Corporations are people whose free speech rights and religious rights cannot be infringed. The right to privacy. Well, that's not in the literal words to the Constitution. It's not there. So what does that mean? The government should have the right to constrict your right to marry the person of your choice, to restrict your right to contraception, or to outlaw a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. And critically, the government has no right to infringe on a corporation's right to pay as little wages as they want or to pollute as much as they want. The government doesn't have those rights. Now, sadly, today, there's just no good counterpart to this in our law schools. Many young lawyers believe that the path to success runs through the Federalist Society. So among these, you're going to find our future very conservative judges. Now there's another progressive way of interpreting the Constitution. And Justice Thurgood Marshall talked about that this way. He said, "I do not believe that the Constitution was forever fixed at the Philadelphia Convention. The true miracle was not the birth of the Constitution, but its life, a life nurtured through two turbulent centuries of our own making." Now, it was this Marshall view of the Constitution that permits the Constitution to adapt. For example, in race, the court finally adapted and said, no, separate is not equal. The concept of liberty was held to include the right to privacy, in very personal decisions. With this right to adapt, it became cruel to execute children or the feeble-minded. And hopefully someday it'll become cruel to cold-bloodedly kill people in retribution for killing. Now, none of this progress is in the cold print of the 1789 Constitution. So what I'm telling you is that the Federalist Society is an enemy of our future progress. Now, the next person on the enemy list is the American exceptionalist. When you hear somebody say, "I believe that America is an exceptional country," well, it sounds good. But look out when you hear that. What it means is that international law does not apply to us. Now, with that view, what you can look forward to are such exciting things as regime change, Abu Ghraib and torture, bombing civilians, Guantanamo, and perpetual war that kills our young and enriches the few. Syria, North Korea, Iran, Somalia, Yemen, there's just no end to potential hotspots. The American exceptionalist is today's version of the white man's burden or manifest destiny. And what's the result? Perpetual war with an ever-shifting set of enemies, and a government that spies on its own people who meekly ingest their drugs and enjoy the pleasurable distractions available. Does that sound familiar? Somewhat Orwellian? I think so. It's Orwellian, but you know it's extremely profitable for the few. Now, what's the alternative? We have to embrace negotiation, mediation, diplomacy. Long ago, we created the United Nations hoping to secure peace, but it became a political football in the Cold War. The U.S., China, and Russia have to go back to the founding principles of the United Nations. You know, long ago, in 1953, President Eisenhower gave his Cross of Iron speech, in which he laid out the cost of the Cold War. He said this: "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children." And he went on to say how much it cost. One bomber is a brick school in more than 30 cities. Two electric power plants serving a town of 60,000. It's two fully equipped hospitals. It's 50 miles of concrete pavement. For a single fighter, we pay 500,000 bushels of wheat. For a single destroyer, we could have bought homes that would house 8,000 people. And then he said this: "This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under a cloud of threatening war, it is humanity on a cross of iron." Now, with the American exceptionalist in charge, it may be even worse than Eisenhower saw it, because it's not a cloud of threatening war. It is war in perpetuity all the time. So I want to conclude. In 2016, We Americans took a beating. Our America took a beating. And even the poor supporters of Donald Trump took a beating. They just don't know it right now. And in my view, Bernie Sanders has taught us how to fight back, and fight back we must, against the enemies who stand against us. I know I felt awfully low back in November, but since then, many Americans have shown me that we are ready for a fight back. We are itching to ride America and make it a friend to our fellow human beings on this planet and a friend to the planet itself. So please allow me to paraphrase the beautiful poet Maya Angelou as I say to Trump and to the kind of people whom he's invited into his cabinet. You may write us down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trot us in the very dirt, but still, like dust, we rise. And thank you very much.
Going back to your comments relating to American exceptionalism and the United Nations, sometimes the United Nations doesn't function in a manner that actually propels world peace and addresses topical problems in various countries. So how do you feel that this could be improved so that we do not see incidences in somewhat remote areas where tyranny results in the death of many, many people before the world population can appropriately respond?
Well, the only thing that I have to say is that might help. It's going to take a true commitment by the United States, Russia, and China, by these governments to say, hey, we've got to get it together. We've got to get together and work together or the world is just going to continue in chaos. I wish I had a better answer for you, but I don't. Do you have an answer?
I'm Jane Stover of the Social Responsibility Board here at All Souls and of Peaceworks. Please give us three reasons, three specifics that you have seen for hope.
Three specific reasons to hope. Well, the giant women's march on Washington, D.C. I mean, that was fantastic. Fantastic. The March for Science. I mean, sure, we have to stand up for reason, you know? And let's see, what else? I love the Fight for 15. I think especially our local group are fighting hard. And not only do they organize for 15, but they educate the people that they're working with. They teach them history. They teach them how to speak. And when you go to one of their events, it's not, the organizer. It's not the organizers who are talking. It's the low wage worker who's speaking. So they give me hope.
Good morning. I'm wearing my tie-dye today with a cross on it because I'm a crispy Christian hippie. Blessed are the peacemakers. See? And At noon at the Plaza Fountain, there's going to be a march today. It's an annual march. I invite everybody to be in on that. I am leading up to a question. Genesis 1:29. I want to know why churches as a whole, when 70%, over 70% of Kansas City voted yes on Proposition 5, I want to know why churches are so reluctant. And when we have Trump saying he's a Christian, how can you tear out the first page of the Bible, Genesis 1:29? How can we ignore the Stanley brothers in Colorado that are saving five-year-old children from epilepsy, cancer, schizophrenia, PTSD? How can we deny seeds that are higher in protein than soybeans? Food, fuel, fiber, okay? And it's not just about, you know, one herb. It's about St. John's wort that took the FDA forever to approve. It's about every green herb bearing seed, and God says it's good. So how do churches ignore this? Woe to those that say good is evil and evil is good. Why is no being in the world are you subject to ordinances, touch not, taste not, handle not? How come churches ignore all this?
Okay, your question is how do they ignore it? I didn't know they did. I really didn't.
Fred, thank you for 4 decades of leading the good fight and being involved in many issues, many causes.
And thank you, Henry, for 4 decades of the same thing.
In regard to the Federalist Societies in our law schools, I suggest that the National Lawyers Guild and the ACLU should also have chapters in the law schools to give that diversity of view. The second thing is that, and this is more like a question, all information is out there, but why do people not take responsibility? So few people are willing to hold signs in public or do a protest or get arrested or whatever, but this country belongs to us, so why do people not take more responsibility?
That's a really good question, Henry. I don't know the answer, really. I do think that people feel overwhelmed by money and politics. Maybe that's a reason that they feel like, you know, we can protest, but do we win? And you have to have victories, or you give up.
Another question about the Federalist Society and the practice of law. It seems to me, particularly when you look at the decisions of Scalia, but he not alone, that in fact what you termed originalists are pre-constitutionalists, that their worldview matches that of the Articles of Confederation much more closely than it does the Constitution. So I'm wondering, is there, within your knowledge of the law, of legal theory, some acknowledgement of the fact that basically these guys are Tories and not Democrats at all?
You know, that's a good question, and I think basically you make a really good point. So thank you.
Thank you for excellent analysis. I greatly admire President Obama. However, recently he accepted a speaking fee of $400,000. Before that, Hillary was regularly accepting $200,000, $300,000, and before that, Bill Clinton was accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars for speaking fees, often from big corporations. How do you think this relates to your criticism of Democratic insiders, and is this the kind of negative symbolism that we have to get rid of?
Well, I think it is, but I just don't know how you do get rid of it, you know. It's the, you know, American way to, good God, make as much money as you can make. And if these banks and institutions are willing to pay our politicians to go talk to them, oh, it's sad. I mean, you know, it has the influence that it has. I don't know how we stop it. I really don't. I mean, I think that fact hurt Hillary a ton. You know, for him to be able to tell people that she's been out making that kind of money, and her and Bill Clinton have been out making that kind of money and taking the money from who they took it from. So, yeah, that's pretty much exactly the kind of thing that is hurting the Democratic Party.
Thanks immensely. And speaking of hurting the Democratic Party, Jim Hightower recently said, in answer to the question, what's good about the Democratic Party, is that it's there. You've touched upon how it can be used. Would you elaborate on how the established Democratic Party can be used for us?
Like he said, it's there. I think that, you know, that's a fairly intelligent statement. In other words, it's there to be used. We just have to use it. You know, we have to get our kind of people to run. We have to give them the money to do it, because, you know, it does take money. But that's one thing that I think Bernie Sanders helped prove, is you don't have to be backed by the giant corporations and the giant money. You can run on real people's money. So other than that, I haven't analyzed it. I'm not a politician. I've never run for office. But, you know, just here locally, we're fortunate. We have good people, good Democrats representing us. People who pretty much stand up for the kind of things that we believe in. And somehow we've got to spread that out from somehow. We win in the cities. We win in where there's a lot of people in the cities. And we lose out in the country, in the farm areas. So somehow we've got to get that message out. And I do think that that's one good thing about the $15 an hour movement, is that there are people making minimum wage all over this state, you know, who are starving on that minimum wage. And so I think that is a way to spread the word of our kind of politics, is through that movement.
This is not a question, but I note that Mr. Obama gave $2 million to a charity in the Chicago area, I think, to support youth programs. Is he doing these speeches to raise money for his charities or for his own pocket?
I'm sorry, sir. I didn't hear quite the last part of your statement.
Is he doing these speeches to enrich himself or to raise money for his charities?
You know, I've got to believe myself that Obama is not trying to enrich himself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's an honorable man, so that's my belief.
Thanks again for coming. I know you heard you're working with this $15 an hour movement. I think that's excellent, but the movement is that there are not going to be any jobs. I mean, $15 an hour is great for a job, but just recently they were talking, President Trump was bragging about expenditure of money at a Honda plant in Georgetown, Kentucky. Well, that is not going to add one single job to that plant after it's over. It's totally automation. And How do we go about reforming our society to understand that, like I said, in about a couple more generations, there's going to be very, very few jobs? How do we redistribute the money?
Well, it's a good, very good observation. You know, you don't have to have near as many workers even in a McDonald's if everything's ordered from a computer. We're going to have to train people to do the new jobs that we're going to have. And we're going to have to make education available to everyone, because they're going to have to train for something new. And while they're doing it, they're going to have to live. They're not going to have live like, you know, like students who are sleeping on the floor, you know. So how we do it, God, I don't know, but we're going to have to take, there's tremendous wealth in this country, but it's stuck in the 1% pockets. And we got to get that, some of that money out of those pockets and into those other pockets. And so that redistribution of wealth has to happen, and would it ever happen fast enough to, as change, because change is so fast. So it's a tremendous structural problem. But if we don't change the way we tax people and get some of this money back out into the economy, I know one thing, if you take money from the 1% and you give it to someone who's making $10 an hour, that money's going to be spent tomorrow. It's going to be out there vibrating, building in, within the economy. Whereas if you leave that money in the 1% pockets, I don't believe that it's going to trickle down to us. So that's as much as I know about your topic, which isn't very much. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
I'm impressed as usual. We have an honorary cup that we give to speakers. And this is made in America, I'm told. So anyway, that's your collection, Pat.
Well, thank you very much.
Next week, we'll have John Hoffman from, he's the president of Arts Alive, a group that has been touring the city monthly to look at art activities that are not all that well understood in Kansas City. And I happen to be a member, and he's a good friend of mine now. And I encourage you all to come next week. You're also welcome to stay for the service. And thank you all for coming today.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, What's to be Done? Assessing Social and Economic Justice with Fred Slough. This program was recorded on Sunday, May 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.